Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stachow. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. London is reeling after another day of high tension in the wake of yesterday's attacks or attempted attacks and the deadly bombings on July 7th. Earlier today, about 10 a.m. London time, plainclothes police shot and killed a man at a subway station, and Police Commissioner Ian Blair says that shooting was directly related to the probe into the bombings.
The information I have available is that this shooting is directly linked to the ongoing and expanding anti-terrorist operation. I need to make clear that any death is deeply regrettable. But as I understand the situation, the man was challenged and refused to obey police instructions.
Authorities in London also released the images of four men they want to question in connection with yesterday's attacks, and they appeal to the public for help in identifying the men and bringing them in for questioning. The images are from closed-circuit TV pictures taken in the London Underground yesterday. Andy Heyman is Assistant Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police.
It's time for the public to do what they're very good at, which is support investigations. It's for us to decide whether any information that is given is of relevance.
Joining us now from London to talk about today's developments is Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Frank.
Let's talk about the shooting today. What more do we know about that?
Well, the shooting took place at the Stockwell Underground Station. Now, the Stockwell Tube Stop is probably a 10-minute walk from the Oval Tube Stop, which was the scene of one of the incidents yesterday. It's pretty clear that the place had been staked out by plainclothes police. Now, it's interesting that gunplay was involved. As listeners will know, in Britain, policemen don't carry firearms. But these were obviously detectives from the special branch armed unit. They were aware that there was a suspect in the vicinity. And according to eyewitnesses, what happened is a man was chased down the platform, ordered to stop, ran in and out of one of the carriages, was then corralled by police. He did not, as we heard the Metropolitan Police Commissioner say, stop and respond to the challenges, and shots were fired and he was killed.
And the commissioner said he's wanted in connection with the terrorist investigations, but not in particular with one or other, the other of the bombings.
Well, he played those cards very close to his chest. Everything is going on around London today, and there are houses being searched constantly, and he took no questions at this press conference. Mm-hmm. And it was really clear that he wanted to give away no information that any of the suspects who are on the run might learn, and it might have helped them escape further.
What we did see in this news conference was pictures now of suspects that are wanted in connection with yesterday's bombings. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was quite remarkable. They released CCTV footage, that's closed-circuit television footage, of four men, one of whom was on a bus. You remember one of the incidents yesterday was a bomb mm-hmm. left on a bus.
Right.
Three from underground stations where or near where the incidents occurred. They are remarkably clear. What I found most interesting was the picture from the Oval showed a young man wearing a windbreaker that had New York written on it.
Right.
He had a shaved head and a very thin, close-cropped beard. And one of the eyewitnesses to this morning's shooting at Stockwell, who claimed to be standing near the man who was shot, described him as being shaven-headed and with a close-cropped beard. That may mean nothing, but I found that interesting. The other picture that was released, and this was also remarkable to me, was a photo of the bomb that had not detonated on the bus. That bus, the number 26 bus, which was stopped in Hackney, was kept in place overnight while the police gingerly examined it and apparently were able to remove the backpack which contained the bomb. And this will, of course, tell them an enormous amount of information about how these bombs are made and perhaps lead them to the bomb maker.
Michael, we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering about the mood, and I know the police commissioner warned against reacting to rumors, but as a way of gauging the mood, what are the rumors now that sweep London?
Well, there's there's rumors going all over the city, rumors about who was shot. There's been bomb threats against mosques. And, of course, the most remarkable thing about this is London does not lack for media. And as the police turn up at a place, so do the camera trucks. And so the city can simply watch on a kind of live streaming feed events. And, of course, all you're getting is a wide shot. Currently, there's an investigation in West London along the Harrow Road, started in an internet cafe where a woman was detained, mm-hmm. and then just around the corner a house was surrounded. Yeah. And so on. And so this is going on all around the city well into the afternoon. Well, it's coming into the evening time now.
All right. Here and now is Michael Goldfarb from London. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Frank.
With medical costs soaring and states trying to figure out ways to balance budgets, public health care programs find themselves in the crosshairs these days. But rather than cut benefits, recent reports in the New York Times suggest states might be better off improving the way they police their Medicaid programs. The reports revealed rampant fraud and abuse in New York State. They also showed that a lot of the fraud was being committed by doctors and other health care and service providers, including a doctor who knowingly diverted more than $11 million in AIDS drugs to steroid-using bodybuilders. Michael Luo co-wrote the series with reporter Clifford Levy of the New York Times. Michael, welcome.
How you doing, Frank?
I'm fine. The first piece you wrote details some of the ways that you can cheat the system. Vans that are supposed to transport people who can't walk, actually they're walking, and frankly they're not using them at all. School officials who signed low-income students up for speech therapy without evaluating them. And then there's the Dr. Dolly Rosen. Why don't you start there? Tell us about her.
Dr. Rosen, we found by analyzing billing records that we obtained from New York State under the Freedom of Information Act, and what we were looking for, the idea in our analysis was to see if we could go out and find fraud, just with our laptop computer and using Microsoft Access, finding cases that the state didn't find. And we came across Dr. Rosen really early on. It was really obvious because her billings essentially went from nothing to over $4 million in 2 or 3 years, and it was a very noticeable spike. She had by far the largest dental practice in Medicaid in the entire state.
So the first spike is this, the first red flag is this huge increase in billings, right?
Right. And then we looked more closely at, well, what is going on here? Are the billings legitimate? And so, you know, the thing you do, you start breaking it down into smaller and smaller pieces, and we looked at, you know, how many procedures did she bill in a month? How many procedures did she bill in a day? And we found this one day in 2003 when she billed for 991 procedures in a single day. And these were, you know, not just like, you know, simple quick procedures. They were, you know, complicated fillings, and we ran these by dental experts and essentially told us it would take like 14 dentists to do what she was doing.
And the point is that you're able to find that using Access, which is a fairly simple, easy to get application that simply pulls these records together and counts for you.
For most people, they must be wondering, like, how could this have happened? And it's not to say necessarily that the people at the Department of Health, which is responsible for looking for fraud in Medicaid, are incompetent or anything. In my mind, it's because the program is just so overwhelmingly large, and you can only be looking in a certain number of spots, especially when your manpower is decreased by so much over the last 10, 20 years when Medicaid has ballooned in New York.
Yeah, but it seems to me that if you're administering a program that's dealing with over $40 billion, oversight is going to be one of the most important aspects of it, that you're going to really fund that.
Well, maybe that's what you would think. what we found is that there is a kind of a cultural tension within the Department of Health when it comes to dealing with fraud, because when you keep in mind that the Department of Health is a public health entity, its job is really to provide services, and when it comes to providing services for the poor, it's sometimes hard to attract providers to do that, and so their main mission is to pump out checks to these providers and keep them in the system so that they'll keep providing care, and as a result, they neglect this fraud detection aspect, and also there might even be a institutional willingness to look the other way, because when you think about it, say you find fraud in some nursing home in upstate New York, and they have to go and shut down this nursing home. It's the Department of Health's job to figure out what are you going to do with these patients. And so it's a difficult dilemma for them.
But the important thing to point out here is that while there's billions of dollars in fraud that we're talking about, it's not poor people who are the beneficiaries of this.
Right. The perception often is that it's recipients who are scamming the system, people who make more than the income level that's the cutoff for Medicaid. But actually, we concentrate on provider fraud, as in like the healthcare providers, doctors, dentists, chiropractors, podiatrists, because actually their fraud accounts for a much larger percentage of the program. It's a much larger dollar figure. The recipient fraud really pales in comparison compared to the provider fraud in terms of sheer dollars.
Well, and there's another kind of fraud here that I found fascinating. If we go to Buffalo, New York, public school officials there signed up more than 4,000. In fact, one official signed up more than 4,000 kids for speech therapy paid for by Medicaid, and none of those kids needed it, as far as we can tell.
Right. I mean, yeah, this was one official who signed up all these kids in one day. And this is uncovered in audits by the federal government. That's the thing with Medicaid. It's one of our sources called it a honeypot. I mean, everyone is using it for their own ends to line their own pockets, and including providers, including school districts, including the New York State itself, in terms of just trying to get more money into their coffers.
Yeah, and let's make it clear that the example that we're talking about in Buffalo, in that case, it wasn't that school official who got rich, and it wasn't even speech therapist. This is the way they're funding their school system.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe that's less outrageous to people, but I mean, when you consider how big of a budget item a Medicaid is in New York State, it's 40% of our spending. And New York is unusual because actually localities share in the cost of paying for Medicaid. So they pay 25% of the cost, and the state pays 25%, and the feds pay 50%. Counties are going, you know, almost bankrupt paying for Medicaid.
How long has this been going on? Has it been sort of gradually getting out of hand, or has it been this way since the program started back in, what, 66, right?
When you look at the history of the program, the first decade or so of the program, they didn't really consider fraud as something to be worried about. And actually, it was New York that really took the lead in the beginning. There was this big nursing home scandal in the 70s, which prompted the creation of a special prosecutor's office in New York to focus on Medicaid fraud. This is an age-old problem, and that was actually something I worried about when I came into the project. I was like, you know, Medicaid fraud has been written about before, but what we found is it's still going on, and these schemes are maybe getting less obvious, but getting more sophisticated in how they steal from the system.
We're talking with Michael Luo, a reporter for the New York Times, who, along with his colleague Clifford Levy, uncovered fraud and waste throughout New York State's Medicaid system, a system that, as Michael says, accounts for 40% of the spending in that state. Our conversation will continue in a moment. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Here and Now. We're speaking with Michael Luo, a reporter for the New York Times. He, along with his colleague Clifford Levy, documented provider fraud in New York State's Medicaid program. Michael, just how sophisticated is this fraud and abuse? Sounds to me like you just have to bill Medicaid.
The examples that we found are pretty obvious, but there are more sophisticated things that are going on out there that probably, you know, we didn't find with our primitive resources. But yeah, I mean, there is an aspect to Medicaid where it seems like all you got to do is fill out your forms correctly, and your claim will go right through the system.
How much of this is a matter of technology? You're talking about a program that began in 1966. Now there are ways of sort of getting at this, but at the same time, it seems to me the program has gotten more complex. Is it just a matter of folks not figuring out that it's a real easy thing to collate this information now digitally and come up with red flags?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, New York, had a very ancient computer system for a long time. Something that we didn't get into, but we had done a lot of reporting on, was on the capabilities of this computer system. And New York had actually set out back in 1998 to replace this system, but through a lot of bungling, it took them 7 years to replace it, when other states have taken like 2 or 3 years to do something similar. And right now, they actually do have completely in place a modernized computer system that supposedly has fraud detection software, sophisticated upfront controls. But the thing is, like, what we found is, even though they have this technology, you need bodies to check out these things that the computer kicks out. Even with this technology, there's still a limited number of places that they have been looking. And for some reason, a lot of these things that we found, even the state with their sophisticated technology wasn't able to find.
Well, you talked about the bodies. And your report suggested that they've been actually cutting back the number of enforcement folks. Other states, you say, have found that it's a really smart sort of, on the cost-benefit scale, very smart to put enforcement people in place.
Right. In New York, we focused a lot on the specific unit in the Department of Health that is in charge of investigating provider fraud. And we found that the unit has basically been cut in half. If you look back to what it was in the late 1980s, when the Medicaid program was just a fraction of its current size. There are certain states that have done a bunch of work recently in expanding their fraud staffs. Like California had some big scandals in the 90s, and they dramatically increased their fraud staff, and has seen their recoveries go up and their savings go up. And Texas, actually, a year or two ago, set up a special inspector general's office that focused on Medicaid fraud, and they've seen their recoveries jump like 25% in a single year. They didn't even spend any more money on the program. They actually just reorganized and just focused on fraud, and it produced this increase.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of cities that have figured out that the Parking Violations Bureau is a real revenue center.
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, I think there are ratios that they use for this prosecutor's office called Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that all states are required to have. And they said that every worker who's hired for that brings in $200,000 in savings. Yeah. And so it seems to make sense to hire fraud investigators.
Let's look ahead. Governor Pataki has ordered an overhaul of the agencies that deal with Medicaid and fraud. Largely as a result of your reporting, how much money do you think has been lost to fraud and waste?
This is a very difficult question, and one that we really wrestled with. In the past, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office in Washington, has suggested in their reports, not through any kind of like official study or anything, but just by looking at what various industry experts say and estimated, that maybe 10% of all healthcare spending in general, of which Medicaid is a part of, is lost to fraud and abuse. When we talked to investigators who work specifically in New York, they used a higher figure. They said that they used to think that in the universe that they were looking at, 10% of the claims were out and out fraud, as in like delivering services that were never provided. But you know, up to as much as 30% could be what they called abuse, like maybe it's not criminal, but it's probably medically unnecessary, just sort of padding tests, padding services and things like that. But really, in the end, I wouldn't want to swear by any figure, because really, if you think about it, the only way to really count this stuff is to really do a criminal investigation into every single claim. No one has done that. And, I mean, some states have tried to measure the amount of fraud in the program. It's a pretty complicated effort. You need to talk to patients, and sometimes that can be difficult. But New York has never tried to formally measure how much fraud is in their program. I mean, one of the things that would really confirm to us how badly New York was doing was in this aspect of a number of suspicious cases they referred to prosecutors. And in New York, they only found in the last year like 37 cases, when, you know, we have a $45 billion program. And we called all six other major states, with the next largest Medicaid programs, and all of them found way more than that. In Texas found like seven times as many, or California found like three times as many. I mean, even like Ohio and Illinois, you know, beat us by a significant amount. So it was pretty clear to us that something was wrong with the Department of Health's fraud detection apparatus, whatever it was.
Did you get the sense that New York State officials ever talked to other folks in other states to do the kind of comparison you did?
No, I don't think they have actually. There hasn't really been like this, like a comprehensive sort of comparison on some of these statistical categories that we looked at. I think we were probably among the first to sort of just pick up the phone and call people and ask them, how many did you do of this? How many on-site audits did you conduct? You know, what is your what percentage of people do you accept into your program in terms of providers? And yeah, they probably don't know.
No, it's stacked up. I'm putting the fraud detection budget together here. I've got laptop, computer, telephone.
Right.
And that's pretty much it.
Right.
Yeah. Michael Luo of the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, democracy in Iraq hinges on its new constitution. We'll find out how the process is going and concerns that women's rights could be limited. Plus, the mystery and wonder of the Syringa Tree, a one-woman play that takes us into the heart of South Africa during apartheid. That's next week. Stay with us. There is more ahead Here and Now. I'm Frank Stasio. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. Saudi Arabia's top envoy to Washington is resigning after 22 years. Prince Bandar bin Sultan is leaving his post as ambassador to the U.S., citing private reasons. This comes at a time of growing political uncertainty in Saudi Arabia as the country prepares for a possible transition of power from the ailing King Fahd to Crown Prince Abdullah. Joining us to talk about Prince Bandar and what the change of guard in Washington means for U.S.-Saudi relations is Robin Wright, a Washington Post diplomatic correspondent. Hi, Robin.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
Prince Bandar has been a close confidant of U.S. presidents during his tenure. He's reportedly somewhat larger than life, a colorful character. Tell us about him.
Well, he is. He has enormous influence in Washington, more than any diplomat in recent history, probably many decades. He could enter the White House or the State Department almost at whim without advance notice. He had security clearance at the State Department. He once showed up for a strategy session at 10 p.m. at night with 10 bags of McDonald's hamburgers to discuss a subject that was still secret and without advance notice that he was coming. He is always full of surprises.
How did he gain this security clearance, for one thing?
Well, Saudi Arabia, first of all, is tremendously important to the United States and has been since the legendary meeting between President Roosevelt and King Fahd, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia. But because of his willingness to find ways to blend the interests of both countries with Saudi Arabia's wealth and America's power, he rose very quickly. And a man who was a former jet fighter pilot, not a former diplomat. He could find solutions to problems of mutual concern. There was at one point in the 1990s when the Clinton administration was trying to figure out how to contain Iran at a time that Iran was looking to buy a new set of airplanes, and both Boeing and Airbus in France were competing. And so Bandar went home and talked to the king, and they turned around and decided that they would buy an all-American replacement for their entire fleet, which bailed out the Clinton administration and the West Coast aircraft industry, and didn't matter then what Iran did.
And in fact, Prince Bandar was influential, in fact, critical in the talks with Libya's Muammar Gaddafi at a couple of different points along the way.
Oh, Prince Bandar is such a great character, and he was intent on getting the United States and Libya back into a dialogue after the 1988 bombing of Pan Am 103, which Libya played the role, the prominent role.
Right.
And so when the Clinton administration refused to see him, he very cleverly went to Nelson Mandela in South Africa, who also wanted to see rapprochement. President Clinton soon after went to South Africa, and Mandela said, I need to talk to you one-on-one. Let's go to the next room. They moved into the next room, and there, waiting for both of them, was Prince Bandar. And Zandi Berger, the national security advisor at the time, was furious about the way that Prince Bandar had outwitted him and actually gotten to the president of the United States through another world's leader. And in the end, the two nations did begin talking, and many of the early secret dialogue talks between Libya and the United States were conducted at Bandar's residences, he has several, in Europe.
So can you give us an idea of how much influence Prince Bandar has in Saudi Arabia?
He is a member of the royal family and the son of the current defense minister, so that line alone gives him important clout. But you have to remember that the founder of Saudi Arabia had 43 sons, and each one of them had several sons, so the royal family is enormous.
And after the 9/11 attacks, I guess there are questions about Prince Bandar's wife, Princess Haifa, that her charitable contributions may have ended up in the hands of people with close ties to the hijackers.
Well, that issue has, in the eyes of the administration, been settled, the State Department said this week. Yes, there was a concern about it at the time because some of the charities were giving money in ways that could be used for dual purposes, as they say.
Let's talk about his replacement, Prince Turki Al-Faisal. He's the son of the late King Faisal, and he's been named as the new ambassador. What can you tell us about him?
He is currently the ambassador to Britain, but his real role in most of his adult career has been as the former chief of Saudi intelligence. And he was very instrumental in trying to get the Taliban in advance of 9/11 to drop its support of Osama bin Laden. There are some reports that he had contacted bin Laden, who is a Saudi renegade whose family and wealth comes from the kingdom. He was actually named in a $100 trillion suit filed by some 9/11 families. It was eventually dropped. But he will be, at this particular juncture, an important intermediary between Washington and Riyadh, but of a very different sort than Prince Bandar has been.
How so?
Prince Turki is probably likely to play an important role in this era of terrorism by Islamic extremists. This is a time where the exchange of information and access is really critical, and I suspect he will be more involved in security issues, whereas Bandar was much more involved in diplomatic initiatives.
Stephen Schwartz of the Weekly Standard writes that this change in ambassadorship is tied to some of the factions in the Saudi royal family. This has a lot to do with what's going on now in Saudi Arabia. Tell us about what's happening in Saudi Arabia and why Ambassador Bandar may want to go back there at this point.
Well, I think Bandar is interested in leaving the job in part because he's been here for 22 years. But Saudi Arabia is at a real juncture, both in terms of its political future and the challenges it faces in security. King Fahd was incapacitated by a stroke in 1995, and his half-brother, Crown Prince Abdul, has been the de facto leader since then. But you also are at a point when many of the original 43 sons are now aging. Some of them have already died. And it's time, many believe in Riyadh, to begin thinking about the next generation of princes, bringing them into power so that there is some new blood, younger energy in the process. But Saudi Arabia also faces real security challenges with the spate of bombings over the past 2 years that have targeted Saudi installations as well as compounds where Westerners live. This was a place that remains a police state and yet can't come to full grips with challenges within from al-Qaeda extremists.
Well, a police state where things, by many accounts, seem to be getting worse or more unstable.
Well, clearly the security situation is in question for the first time. I'm not sure that the royal family is under the kind of threat that will lead to change anytime soon. The forces of change in the region are also, you know, having an impact in the kingdom. And Saudi Arabia had its first municipal elections this year, just for men. Tightly controlled, but they were elections, a reflection of the fact that even in Saudi Arabia, the winds of change are beginning to blow.
Robin Wright is a Washington Post diplomatic correspondent. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email to letters@here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.ORG. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, refugee stories and epic poetry make for heavy summer fare. Theater critic Bill Marks joins us with his review of the Lincoln Center Arts Festival. You're listening to Here and Now. A disturbing trend is emerging on websites in Japan. People looking to commit suicide are connecting via the internet and taking part in group suicides. In the first 3 months of this year, there were 20 cases of group suicide with 54 deaths. That's about the same number as all of last year. Japan has the highest suicide rate in the developed world, and it's about twice as high as in the United States. Joining us on the line to talk about the issue is Matt Rusling, who writes for the Christian Science Monitor in Osaka, Japan. And Matt, tell us a little more. Describe these websites and how they're being used.
The websites, when you log on to them, they've kind of got this black background, kind of foreboding kind of writing. They're being used by a number of people from different walks of life. They tend to be a lot of young men, though, a lot of lonely young men. And they're being used basically to meet other people for the purpose of committing suicide.
Can you tell if these folks who have met on the internet and are committing group suicide were about to commit suicide anyway? In other words, is the overall suicide rate going up as a result of these group suicides?
The overall suicide rate peaked a few years ago, and it's gone down a little bit since. But in general, it's been growing. A lot of people on the site say they're looking for someone to commit suicide with, which suggests to me that they might not do it alone. It might be something more difficult to do by themselves.
Matt, do you, as someone who's had to learn the culture and has come with other cultural expectations to Japan, what's your insight about how the Japanese view suicide?
Well, I think there's been a certain amount of glorification. If you look at a lot of the words that dot the Japanese vocabulary, there are a lot of terms for different kinds of suicides. For example, harakiri is something that samurai warriors did, considered a noble means of escape from disgrace or defeat. There's something called shinju, which is a double suicide of two lovers. There's oyako, which is family suicide. There's also kamikaze, which is suicide bombers of World War II. So I think, that in itself is pretty significant, that there's just so much terminology to do with suicide here, and a lot of the terminology goes back quite a while.
Do you have any insights into why Japan would have such a high suicide rate?
There doesn't really seem to be much of a sense of optimism here, especially among youth. I wouldn't say Japan has a youth culture that's specifically optimistic about the future. And I would also, I spent about a year in Korea as well, comparing Korea to Japan. I would say the youth in Korea are much more optimistic about the future.
How has the Japanese public reacted to these stories, Matt?
Pretty much sort of shrug their shoulders and think, well, there's nothing I can do about it.
Matt, is anything being done about these websites to restrict them in any way?
Yeah, there are some guidelines being set in place right now by the authorities, and they're guidelines of how to request information from the ISPs to give the personal information of people who are disseminating what they think is harmful information. That can include plans for group suicides, things like that. But I would say since suicide is not a crime here, the fact that the police are doing even that is pretty significant.
Matt, it seems to me that one of the risk factors for suicide is in fact loneliness, and I wonder if in some strange way the idea that people are getting together on websites, even to talk about suicide, could in some way be therapeutic.
I did view a couple of sites where someone had a specific date in mind for a group suicide, and he was telling people to come to a certain mountain area and just everyone commit suicide together. And there was that message, and there were a few people that were interested, but on the other hand, when I looked at that site the next day, there were a lot of people who got online and were saying, don't do it, and there's reason to live, and things like that. So I think that some of the sites have a secondary function, which is people just being able to talk about their suicidal thoughts or tendencies.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Matt Rusling is a contributor for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Osaka, Japan. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. If you're looking for an alternative to escapist summer entertainment, New York City's Lincoln Center could be the place for you. The Lincoln Center Festival 2005 is featuring works by the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, avant-garde theater director Robert Wilson, and an epic drama based on the stories of refugees. Here and Now theater critic Bill Marks has sampled a couple of the offerings at the festival, which runs through the end of this month, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
How you doing, Frank?
I am fine. Plenty of heavy fare here. Refugee stories, dramas based on epic poems from Indonesia. Is this typical of the festival?
Well, it's very typical of the festival. About 10 years ago, the festival decided that it wanted to offer some sort of an alternative to the usual sort of brain-numbing summer fair. And they decided that they would try to make a go of it by reaching out internationally. I spoke to a Nigel Redden, who's the director of the Lincoln Center Festival, just about how this came about.
The word on the street was Strauss waltzes or die. And we decided that this was not a direction we could go in for a variety of reasons, that what we wanted to do was to do something that would really be important for Lincoln Center and would extend what Lincoln Center really is. It would extend its reach beyond sort of the classics of Western civilization and expand it to include classics from other parts of the world as well. It was a bumpy road at first, but quite clearly we have managed to get an audience for work that is not Strauss waltzes.
And, I mean, I really find that to be refreshing. I mean, that's so admirable that there's no reason why people have to put their brains into neutral during the hot weather. And it's a perfect time, in a sense, to bring people to try something a little bit different.
Well, you have a little more time to get your head around something as important, I suppose, as refugee stories. New York Times is calling Le Dernier Caravanserai. And because my French is bad, I'll tell you, that means The Last Caravan. It says one of the hottest tickets in the festival. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a hot ticket for a number of different reasons. One reason, of course, is the timeliness of the piece. It deals with refugee stories from Afghanistan, Kurdistan, Iraq, and Iran. It's all based on real-life stories. In other words, the company went and spoke to refugees and decided to boil down, a number of, they must have gotten hundreds of stories, to about 40 stories. The work itself is about 6 hours long, 3 hours spurts. Part one is three hours, and then the second is 3 hours. But another reason really why it's a hot ticket, besides the timeliness of the subject, is the director, Mnuchin, who is a celebrated European figure.
Tell us a little more about the origin of this piece.
Well, this is unusual for Mnuchin to the extent that it isn't a set text. She's often done Greek tragedies and Shakespeare. But she went out and spoke to refugees in various asylums and camps. And she essentially was touched enough by the stories where she felt compelled, when I talked to her, to do this piece, to do this epic drama.
Here they are in a refugee asylum, and they only have one bag or one suitcase, and they're telling their story and their separation to you, and you have to tell them that you can't do anything for them because you're not a police, you're not government official, you're not journalist. That's a good thing, because then they start telling the truth to you instead of telling, you know, a sort of pre-invented story. So what can you do? And then one day I've heard myself say, well, I can't do it, except maybe I can tell these stories. And then it became a promise, of course. It really began, and we had to do it. But we didn't do it because we had to do it. Yeah. We did it because we wanted to. But we had to do it, of course.
Obviously, it's important, but does it really make good theater?
Well, that's the question, and I think it does make good theater, although not perhaps transcendent theater. Mnuchin is known not well in this country, but is known, celebrated throughout Europe, as being a major post-war director, known for doing innovative works of experimental theater, but are also very sort of humane. They're not sort of self-consciously clever, but are very they communicate directly and yet find challenging alternative ways to do that. In this case, you have a lot of stories, many of them horrific. This is not a friendly, a happy piece. There are some happy stories in them or happy endings, but generally it's tales of tragedy and tales of people who are left homeless and often in Western countries that don't want to accept them, you know what I mean, find themselves just sort of, you know, flying or walking or running or finding some place for a home in the globe. And it does make good theater. Her theatrical metaphor, which is to have people not walk across the stage, in other words, the actors never touch the stage. They're on platforms on wheels, and they're sort of tugged around the stage. So the idea is that they're literally life on the fly. But is it poetry? It really doesn't transcend, it seems to me, simply the grim impact, the visceral feelings that you get from seeing these people struggling to find a home.
You spoke of how timely this piece is with stories on Muslim culture. The festival seemed to have quite a bit of Muslim culture as part of it, with the U.S. premiere of Ilagaligo, and it's closed now, but you managed to catch a performance. Is it really based on an epic poem?
It sure is. Wow. It's a poem which apparently has got thousands of pages in it. It's an Indonesian epic that really is little known in the West. It's many times longer than Homer, although I would say that unlike the Iliad and the Odyssey, it doesn't have the dramatic compactness and conflict that Homer has. But it's still a fascinating piece of work. Although obviously, even in a three-hour piece, which is what we're getting in the Robert Wilson production, you're only getting a smidgen of the epic.
Do you have to be familiar? I mean, epic poems work really well for people who are familiar with the tradition or familiar with the literature. What happens when we're not? It works for you?
It does work, partly because Robert Wilson, and people may not know about him, but he's another major director, like Mnuchin, dealing often with international issues. His note of fame is that he's a remarkable designer of theater and of movement. And of course, this production looks stunning. Great costumes, absolutely just wonderful lighting effects. So it helps make up for the fact that the epic itself is perhaps not the most dramatically compelling. My favorite part of the piece, though, frankly, is the music, which I just think is a fabulous sort of homage. I mean, it makes use of traditional Indonesian sounds, but also adds certain modern flavor to it as well. And I think it's just a wonderful synthesis of the old and the new.
And that celebration of life from Ilagaligo. Bill, does this music work in this play as a sort of incidental music, or is it
featured work? It's an integral part of it. Yeah. We are getting the subtitled text of the epic, and that tends to be, such and such god went down to the Middle Earth and created a lot of mischief. So along with that, you have obviously choreography, dance movements, and so the music is really an important part of this.
What are some of the other works that people should be looking out for at the festival?
Okay, well, they've got some really good things coming up. There's Modern No Plays, which is coming up from Japan, and they're, as a theater critic, you can't get enough of them, and they don't get done that often in this country, so that's always a treat. There's going to be Servant of Two Masters, an Italian comedy, which is also coming up, and that also looks good. And finally, an opera based on the life of Hans Christian Andersen called My Life is a Fairy Tale. And when I was down there, a number of people told me that that was the next hottest ticket in the festival. A lot of people were interested in that opera.
Plenty of good stuff.
Lots of good stuff and challenging stuff.
Here and now, theater critic Bill Marks with his report on the Lincoln Center Festival 2005. Bill, thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stacio, Robin Young. We'll be back Monday. Join us again, Here and Now.
Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.